ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, Mexico has been ravaged by violence from deadly drug cartels. 90,000 people missing and hundreds of thousands murdered.
Mexico has one of the highest murder rates on the planet, and most of the murders are committed by guns. While the violence is connected with the growth of the Mexican drug cartels, the Mexican government claims it's also connected with the illegal flow of high-powered automatic weapons from the United States. It further claims that US gun manufacturers and sellers are directly marketing and producing weapons for the Mexican drug cartels. Mexico itself has strict gun regulations and only one gun shop for the whole country. So in an attempt to stop this flow of illegal weapons, the Mexican government has filed two lawsuits in the United States, one in Massachusetts against six of the major gun manufacturers, and one in Arizona against five US gun dealers. Mexico is claiming $10 billion in damages. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince. In this Rear Vision, how two lawsuits have the potential to turn the US gun industry on its head. But before we get to these two cases, let's take a closer look at the rise of gun violence in Mexico and the impact it's having on Mexican society.
Yes, so in Mexico, you had for a while a decrease in violence that lasted until about 2007 from the 1990s. And then from 2007, you saw this sudden, really fast increase in violence and murders. The murder rate very rapidly doubling, tripling, and in some cities in Mexico and some states, enormous increases, things like tenfold increases, 20-fold increases in murders. My name is Johan Grillo. I'm a journalist specializing on organized crime and drugs and author of books including Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. You know, I spent the last 23 years living through this and covering it as a journalist. I think this is very clearly linked to this escalation of violence between the drug cartels, which became paramilitary organizations, and are fighting amongst themselves and fighting the government. And there's a whole bunch of other violence of armed militias fighting the cartels, supposedly on behalf of the people, corrupt elements of the government, and so forth. And that's the real driving force behind this incredible carnage. Now, as well as those, the absolute numbers I can give you about murders, such as that since 2006, you've had more than 400,000 murders in Mexico. Quite an incredible number. But as well as the absolute numbers of a lot of this violence, so there's been things like a gun battle with 500 criminal gunmen against 2,000 federal police. There's been single massacres of 72 people. There's been mass graves with more than 300 bodies. And then all these other kind of features you see now of improvised landmines, armored drones, and all of these things which make the violence as well very extreme. And to feel at times more like an armed conflict, like a war, than simply a crime problem.
In 2006, the newly elected Mexican president sent 6,500 Mexican soldiers to take on the drug cartels.
I mentioned the date 2006 as being important, not just because Mexico begins a overt campaign to get rid of these transnational criminal networks, but also because in 2005, in the United States, we see the lapse of the assault weapons ban. My name is Leon Castellanos Jankowicz. I am a senior researcher in international law at the Osser Institute for International and European Law. This was a prohibition of the sale and commercialization of heavy caliber and high firepower weapons that was instituted by President Bill Clinton in 1994. He banned the sale of assault weapons for 10 years, and this ban was not renewed in 2004, which means that a lot of these products went into the market in the United States. Now, they have come into the hands of cartels since then, And we see that this increasing firepower, which is able to pierce body armor, which is able to bring down helicopters, has been used against the Mexican military in the context of this war against drugs, and is causing the spiral of violence that Mexicans have been going through ever since. So it's not just about Mexico having a new strategy in order to bring the cartels under control. That date is also coinciding with a looser policy in the U.S. in respect to these very, very dangerous products.
Hundreds of thousands of people have died in Mexico's drug war over the last 12 years, despite a military campaign and the killing and arrest of leading traffickers.
These weapons, can people buy, or are they buying these weapons actually in Mexico?
Now, Mexico does have a right to bear arms in its constitution. You do have a right to be able to go and buy weapons in Mexico, but it's quite a difficult process. There's one store in the whole country which sells them, which is run by the military. It's here in Mexico City. You arrive at that store, you need seven pieces of identification, seven pieces of paperwork, including a letter from the police. It takes several months for you to apply for this. You know, you still see people buying weapons, but you see pretty small numbers, things like 16,000 guns a year being sold through this store. Whereas there's this huge source of weapons outside of Mexico in the United States where you can buy guns cheaply and easily, and that is really driving this conflict.
And so how do you know, like, the weapons actually do come from the United States?
So when various criminals have been arrested, their guns have been seized and they have serial numbers. Sometimes the serial numbers are there, sometimes they've been scraped off, but they can be restored. And these serial numbers are given to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms and Explosives, known as the ATF in the United States, which is the gun police. And they will do searches for them to test their origin. Now, we know that in the last 15 years or so, there's been more than 180,000 firearms that have been concretely seized at crime scenes or from criminals in Mexico and directly traced to the United States to gun factories or gun stores. So we know for a fact there's been an enormous number, but that number of 180,000 is only a small percentage because they're the guns which have been seized. So there's huge amounts of guns out there that have not been seized. They estimate that about the more than 200,000 firearms a year come from the United States going to Mexico.
Which brings us to the United States and the incredible number of firearms being held by US citizens and sold in gun shops.
Inside, the gun lobby and its faithful defended firearms.
The gun didn't do it. Guns don't shoot by themselves.
As the age-old saying goes, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Have you ever heard that? No, you've never heard that.
By most estimates, there are about 400 million privately owned firearms in the United States. There are only roughly 320 million people. So there are far more firearms than there are people. And of those, there are probably somewhere between 20 million and 40 million AR-15 platform semi-automatic rifles. So the country is really awash in firearms.
Timothy D. Litton, Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law, and author of Suing the Gun Industry.
Firearms have always played an important role in American history, and private access to firearms has played an important role, and that's reflected in the Second Amendment. In addition to that, we just have a very robust and active firearms market, and when American anxiety levels go up, people tend to go out and buy firearms. During COVID, for example, there were big spikes in the annual sales for firearms, and that helps to explain why it is that there are just so many firearms in the United States. And I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges we have to gun control, which is no matter what you do, there's really no way to reduce the vast number of privately owned firearms around the country.
At the end of the 1990s, victims of gun violence in the United States began taking legal action against manufacturers and sellers of firearms. The government responded by giving immunity to the gun industry under an act known as the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLACA.
In the late 1990s and early 2000s, firearms violence victims, started bringing lawsuits not against the people who shot them, but against the sellers and the manufacturers of the weapons that were used to shoot them. And in addition to individuals, municipalities, about 30 municipalities around the country, started suing sellers and manufacturers of weapons for the costs of dealing with emergency response to firearms violence in cities, as well as medical costs. And these lawsuits proliferated all around the United States, and they essentially took three approaches. One was to argue that the design of weapons was especially lethal, and they were unreasonably dangerous, and therefore firearms manufacturers should be responsible when they were misused by criminals. A second one had to do with marketing, the idea that these weapons were being marketed in ways that were irresponsible by promoting them for civilian combat uses, or by placing them in video games, or by promoting them in ways that increase the risk of criminal misuse. And that on that basis, manufacturers and sellers ought to be held liable for firearms violence. And the third was distribution, the idea that manufacturers were selling large numbers of weapons to stores where they knew those weapons were then being illegally sold into the black market, and that the manufacturers are to be responsible for that. And as these suits proliferated around the country, the firearms industry, through its trade association and through the National Rifle Association, which is a private membership organization, lobbied state legislatures, and they secured immunity from these lawsuits in 34 states. And ultimately, in 2005, they secured a federal immunity shield called the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, or known as PLACA. And PLACA essentially says that no person can bring in a state or federal court a lawsuit against a firearms manufacturer or seller for any injury that arises out of criminal misuse of the weapon. So the idea is that if you're injured by some criminal misuses a weapon, you can sue that criminal, but you cannot sue the seller of the weapon and you cannot sue the manufacturer of the weapon.
I'm just wondering, the push by the arms manufacturers and the NRA to bring this piece of legislation into existence, was that very much based on what they'd seen had happened with the tobacco companies?
Yeah, and I think tobacco definitely has influence, but I don't know that that's really the object lesson that the firearms industry had in mind. I think the firearms industry was looking at the asbestos industry, because the asbestos industry suffered nationwide lawsuits against them for the design and distribution and marketing of their product. And as a result, most of those firms went bankrupt. And as we know, the asbestos industry is no more in the United States. And so I think the firearms industry was worried that the litigation costs and ultimately the possibility of having to pay large damage awards might actually drive the industry under. And so they worked around the country to secure this immunity. Now, there are a number of exceptions to the PLACA federal immunity shield from these lawsuits. But essentially, the immunity shield shut down the lawsuits for the most part. And these lawsuits that had proliferated around the country, both individuals and municipalities, essentially dried up. And there were a few attempts to try and come in under exceptions to the PLACA federal immunity shield, but most of those have not done very well. Nevertheless, the case that there are significant limitations to the federal immunity bill, and that's part of what brings us to the Mexico case. And that's where the Mexico case becomes interesting. They're trying to find a way to show that their claim comes in around the federal immunity shield and is not covered by the federal immunity shield.
This is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince. In this episode, we're taking a look at gun violence in Mexico and the Mexican government's attempt to sue US gun manufacturers and sellers. If the US gun industry is protected by the federal immunity law, what arguments are being put forward by Mexico to show that their case is not covered by PLACA?
They launched two lawsuits. One lawsuit was against manufacturers. They sued five manufacturers in a Boston federal court, and they made arguments that the manufacturers were engaged in activity that was aiding and abetting illegal sales practices at retail. And we could talk about the details of those in a minute. But the second lawsuit they brought was against firearm sellers, gun stores. And they argued that those gun stores were also engaged in illegal sales. And they've gotten around PLACA because they've argued that both the manufacturers and the retail stores have been engaged in violations of federal laws relating to the terms under which you can sell a weapon and who can purchase a weapon legally. And on that basis, they've avoided so far a federal immunity shield, both in the case against the manufacturers, which is in Boston, and the case against the retail stores, which is in Arizona.
So PLACA, as you said, is a statute that shields gun manufacturers and gun industry players from civil suits in the U.S. courts under certain conditions. Now, PLACA also has a series of exceptions. So, for example, if a member of the arms industry is committing a crime, then they would not be shielded by PLACA. Mexico argues that PLACA does not apply for two main reasons. The first is that the damage, according to Mexico, that is occurring is happening on its own territory. All of this damage on our territory, and therefore, Mexican law applies to a lot of our claims and our torts, and we request the U.S. judge to apply these Mexican laws in order to determine responsibility of the gun companies and the extent to which they need to provide reparation. Now, in U.S. law, this is important because there is a principle of extraterritoriality. U.S. law cannot be presumed to apply to third countries. And so Mexico, what it's saying is, PLACA does not apply to damage occurring in Mexico and to the violation of Mexican laws. That would be tantamount to saying that you're applying U.S. laws to facts occurring in Australia. And the second argument that Mexico advances is that these gun stores and these gun manufacturers are complicit in aiding and abetting gun traffickers who are transferring these weapons to cartels. And because aiding and abetting in arms trafficking is a federal crime since last year, Congress adopted a bipartisan legislation which criminalizes aiding and abetting for gun trafficking. Mexico says, because PLACA does not shield you from committing a crime, and so therefore the judges have jurisdiction. And this is what the judge, what the panel in the First Circuit agreed with in terms of its own jurisdiction when it allowed Mexico's claims to move forward at trial. And so it decided that because of this aiding and abetting component, Mexico has proven that the gun shops and the gun manufacturers knew or should have known that their products were being used by cartels. The judges have agreed on this premise, and the cases are moving forward.
And what's been the gun manufacturer's response to this litigation?
They essentially say that they do not cause the damage that Mexico is complaining of, that they have no role in arming the cartels, that the damage that Mexico invokes is too far removed from their actions, that there is no causal link between their behavior and the final outcome that is taking place in Mexico. And of course, the gun industry is invoking PLACA as a reason why Mexico should not be in front of the courts in the first place, that there is no jurisdiction of these courts. But for different reasons, the respective courts in Arizona and Massachusetts have done away with that argument. And so very importantly for Mexico, but also for the rest of the anti-gun violence community in the United States, PLACA has been set aside.
So what are the key claims being made by Mexico in these two cases?
Well, there are five leading manufacturers. I believe they are Glock and Smith & Wesson. They include Beretta. And the argument in that case is essentially that the manufacturers are engaged in deliberate facilitation of illegal sales at the retail level. What are called straw sales, that is selling a weapon to a person who's legally entitled to buy the weapon, but who's clearly buying it for someone who's not legally entitled or qualified to buy the weapon. Unlicensed sellers. In order to sell a weapon in the United States, you have to have a federal firearms license. Unless you sell the weapon as a hobby or to your neighbor, it's not really a commercial sale. And so there's an argument that there are a lot of unlicensed sellers, what they call kitchen table dealers or gun shows, where arms are being sold really in a large volume, but they're dressed up as hobby sales, and therefore they don't require a federal firearms license. Off-book sales disguised as inventory theft. Stores will sell weapons off the books without a background check, and they'll then claim that those weapons were stolen from them, and so there's no record of the sale. And finally, oversupply to border dealers, that the manufacturers are selling large quantities or distributing large quantities of weapons to dealers who they know are making these illegal sales. And that, in fact, the firearms manufacturers not only know about this, they count on it. It's actually a feature of their business model. And the ways in which they aid and abet this is they design their weapons in ways that are specifically aimed at appealing to people in Mexico who might want to use them for organized crime. They market them in ways that are designed to appeal by product placement and the types of features that they advertise with the weapons. And finally, that they distribute the weapons to stores where they know they will be facilitating increased traffic into the black market. And if Mexico can prove its claims, then the firearms manufacturers would stand to be liable for some of the costs of firearms violence in Mexico. Keeping in mind that these are just allegations, the courts have essentially said that if Mexico could prove its case, then in fact, that would add up to liability. And so Mexico now has the opportunity to bring evidence to prove its case. Not only will they have to show all of the things that go along with aiding and abetting, that the manufacturers not only know about this, but they're counting on it. It's part of their business model. They also have to show a close enough connection between illegal activities on the part of the manufacturers by facilitating these illegal sales and downstream criminal misuse of the weapon in Mexico. And if a jury doesn't think that there's a close enough connection between the misconduct of the manufacturers and street violence in Mexico, they probably won't link them, what's called proximate cause in law. And if there's not a proximate causal connection, that is, in the mind of a jury, a close enough connection between the misconduct and the ultimate injury, there wouldn't be liability. So that's another hurdle that Mexico faces. So that's the lawsuit essentially in Boston against the manufacturers. The lawsuit in Arizona is a little bit more straightforward. It essentially says that gun stores are essentially selling large volumes of weapons to people with false buyer information that they know are filling out false information on the background check form, that they're selling to obvious traffickers, that they're making repeat sales in the same week of the same gun in bulk sales, and that they're selling tens of thousands of dollars, in one case, $80,000 of weapons to the same person in the course of a year. And that these are obvious flags that the stores are engaged in facilitating illegal trafficking and on that basis are in violation of federal law and are also not covered by the federal immunity shield.
Now the immunity under Plaka has been set aside, Mexico can request information from the 6 gun manufacturers and the 5 gun dealers about their design, marketing, and distribution practices via a process known as discovery.
And the next step is what's called discovery. And discovery allows the plaintiffs, the people who bring the lawsuit, to basically demand information from the defendants regarding the way they do business and any kind of information that might relate to trying to marshal evidence to prove their claims. And so Mexico is going to be asking hard questions to the firearms manufacturers about their design decisions and what sorts of consideration goes into how they design their weapons and who they're trying to appeal to, their marketing campaigns and who they think their target audience is, and their distribution practices. That is how much they know actually about the stores that they're selling to and whether they're in possession of information that would let them know and put them on notice that they're actually fueling the black market, and any other information that might be floating around in emails or corporate memos that might deal with the manufacturers taking advantage of the illegal sales and profiting from them as part of their business model. And essentially, when cases go into discovery, it gives plaintiffs an opportunity to dig out information that is otherwise suppressed that often government regulators can't get at. And if Mexico can gather enough information from this discovery process, they may be able to parlay some of it into proof and bring it before a jury and convince a jury that, in fact, the arguments they're making about the way the industry is profiting off of black market and illegal sales into Mexico are true, and they should be responsible for that.
What did he take?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
It's a deadly addiction, claiming more lives than car crashes or even gun violence. More than 900 Americans from all walks of life now die each week from opioid drug overdoses.
Let me pull them out. Get them on the ground.
The best parallel here to understand what the strategy of plaintiffs like Mexico is in this case is to think for a moment about parallel litigation in the opioid industry. So starting in the late 1990s and early 2000s, individuals who were addicted to opioids started to sue the pharmaceutical companies that made the opioid pills. And the theories they used were that the companies were designing their pills in a way that made them especially addictive, that they were marketing them in ways that made a high risk of criminal misuse, in other words, giving doctors incentives to overprescribe them, and that they were distributing in ways that they knew were leaking into the black market, selling 5 million pills to a small town with 3,000 people in West Virginia, and knowing that those pills were going out into the black market. And these lawsuits started at exactly the same time that the firearms lawsuits started. It turns out that early on, neither of these lawsuits succeeded. The courts just didn't like these theories. They didn't think that pharmaceutical manufacturers were responsible for opioid addiction, and they didn't think firearms manufacturers were responsible for gun violence. In 2005, the firearms industry really, because they got immunity, the firearms industry litigation ground to a halt, more or less. But the pharma industry litigation kept going. And if you fast forward 20 years, we find ourselves in a position where pharma companies have started to lose cases here and there. And you only need a few large cases to lose where there are enormous damages assessed. So the pharma companies are paying out billions of dollars and they are facing orders and regulation that has grown out of the litigation about how to do their business. What's happened is that the pharma industry has taken responsibility for a nationwide epidemic that's a public health crisis. They have changed the way they design their products. They've shifted their marketing and scaled back to be more careful, and they've kept greater care in the tracking of their distribution channels. And they've also paid out billions of dollars that are going towards opioid treatment. And so the industry has essentially taken responsibility for its part in the opioid crisis. And I think the idea is that if firearms litigation could follow a similar path, if it could just get over the immunity bill, it might mature in a way that between the damage awards and possible injunctions or settlements, the industry might be brought around to changing the way they design their weapons, their marketing strategies, and controlling their distribution channels.
What's the likelihood of Mexico being successful? And what impact would that have on Mexico and gun policy in the United States?
This victory of Mexico, if it happens, would be a major wake-up call for the gun industry and for policymakers in the United States in relation to their role in contributing to violence south of the border and in the broader region. And of course, you know, this has big policy implications as well, because just as the United States wants to control migration and wants Mexico to assist it in stemming the flow of unlawful border crossings, so does Mexico respond by saying, well, of course, I'm very happy to help with this, but you also need to stop the flow of illegal guns.
I think one thing to keep in mind about this litigation is a lot of people focus on who's going to win or lose. Is Mexico going to win? Is Mexico going to lose? And I think you can over-focus on the outcome of the litigation sometimes. It's often less important what the outcome of the litigation is than what the process produces. The actual process of filing a lawsuit, going into discovery, and generating media attention for this ongoing story, which is a sort of courtroom drama, often has a greater impact on public policy than the outcome of the case, even if the plaintiffs lose. First of all, when you file a lawsuit, it has a very powerful framing effect on the story. You are shifting the story away from criminal shooters and mental illness and whatever else we might want to talk about to firearms industry players, manufacturers, and their design, marketing, and distribution practices. And that becomes the focus of attention. And that's a way to reframe the problem of firearms violence away from individual criminals to an industry that might be responsible. The second thing is when these cases go into discovery, it gives plaintiffs an opportunity to reveal information that regulators might find useful that they don't already have. And so there may be new information that comes out through the process of litigation. And finally, agenda setting. This litigation tends to put this issue high on the agenda of public policymakers. And we've seen this in the United States. There are many state legislatures now, by last count about 8 or 9, that are passing new state laws that are seeking to impose new restrictions on firearms manufacturers to exercise reasonable controls over their distribution chains. And I think that's part because they have received this new framing from the litigation that's been covered by the media. And so it becomes more important to the public and it becomes more important to state legislators and state governments start to change the way they do business. So those three effects are things that come out of the process of litigation, even if the plaintiffs ultimately fail.
Professor of Law and author of Suing the Gun Industry, Timothy D. Litton. My other guests, Leon Castellanos-Jankovic, Supervisor of the International Law Clinic on Access to Justice for Gun Violence at the University of Amsterdam, and Yon Grillo, journalist specialising in organised crime and drugs and author of Blood Gun Money. Rear Vision's sound engineer is Roy Huberman. I'm Annabelle Quince.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.